I'm Anna Johnston. I'm from the from Salinger Privacy, which is an independent privacy consulting and training firm. But my background is very much as a privacy specialist, privacy advocate, before that privacy regulator. So I've been doing all things privacy for about 20 years now. I guess what I'm enjoying about NetThing is actually getting to meet in person various people I've connected with over social media, other people interested in advocacy on privacy and digital rights from all over Australia. So it's really nice to meet people in person and have those kind of face-to-face chats that normally we have over, you know, Twitter or messaging or email or whatever it is. So it's really good to also bring together people from really diverse backgrounds. So obviously a lot of people here with technology-based backgrounds, but also community organisers and advocates, lawyers, cryptographers, and all the rest. It's really great to have a kind of mixed community.
So privacy is a hot topic at the moment, and it seems that people are slowly waking up to the fact that it is a human right. What would you say about privacy and why it's so important?
So it is, obviously, privacy is a universal human right. It's recognised as such. But I've found that most people, that doesn't necessarily connect for them or have a particular meaning for them. I think we need to recognise instead that privacy is a universal value. We all value it in our own lives. That gets measured in different ways. It gets demonstrated in different ways. For a long time, so I've been working in the area for 20 years, let's say for the first 10 or so years, there was this kind of prevailing theory that privacy doesn't really matter. You know, quotes like, you've got zero privacy, get over it. Young people today don't believe in privacy, they put everything on the internet. That kind of discourse, which I was, you know, I think is incorrect, but that kind of discourse shaped the kind of political narrative and the media narrative. But the good news is that that is now changing. From Edward Snowden to Cambridge Analytica, some of these big scandals have started to open people's eyes to the power of corporates and the power of governments to impact on kind of everyday people's lives. The pervasive nature of both government and corporate surveillance, and people are starting to wake up to the importance of standing up for their own privacy, safety online, security online, digital rights, and all the rest. I think the challenge is, how do people who care about these issues organise themselves, advocate, persuade governments and corporations to do better?
So obviously in Europe we've got the GDPR. In Australia we have the Australian Privacy Principles. But what do you think, how do you think the Australian Privacy Principles are actually working? Do you think it's a good framework, or do you think it's just a start?
I think the Australian Privacy Principles in the Australian Privacy Act, or if you look at the various state and territory privacy laws in Australia, they come from the same fundamental beginnings as the GDPR in Europe. The differences are at the margin. What makes a practical difference is the enforcement and the penalties. So GDPR gets a lot of airplay because the penalties are massive. The regulators, or some of the regulators, are very well funded and they can go pursue kind of strategic litigation, get the big penalties, which actually starts to enable change. In Australia, typically our privacy regulators are very poorly funded. They don't necessarily have the same powers as other regulators. It's very difficult for civil society to bring cases to force change, so the pace of change in Australia is slower. So I don't think the problem necessarily is with the law itself. It could certainly do with tweaking. But the basic privacy principles are effectively the same. They have slightly different language, but they're effectively the same as you see in the GDPR. The difference is in enforcement, driving both changes in both government and corporate practices. That's what we really yet to see in Australia.
In a country like Australia, where people sort of, they really believe Joseph Goebbels, sort of, you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. People sort of quote that without even knowing who's the source of the quote, which is kind of a bit strange, isn't it, that we have this kind of faith in a right to privacy, but yet we have no concept of it, and we're not really engaging in a sort of a healthy way. That must be quite confusing to be kind of right in it. How do you make sense of all this?
I think for anyone who wants to advocate for privacy, first of all, they need to have an understanding of modern history, 20th century world history, as you've just alluded to, but also to form coalitions with people who have been directly affected. So I think it is kind of easy to say whereas Australians have generally been safe and immune from that kind of state-sponsored surveillance, I think we ignore what's already going on right now in Australia. But also it's really important to find the people who did live in or escape from totalitarian regimes. So because they can talk about that experience and draw parallels with, you know, legislation and government powers in Australia now. So years ago now, 12, 13 years ago, I was involved in the campaign against the what was then the proposed National Identity Card Mark II, the Access Card, so it's kind of Australia Card Mark II. And what was really important to help build a coalition of people opposed to that and who could take that discussion to their local representatives and build a political opposition were communities who had escaped from the former Eastern Bloc, you know, Soviet Bloc, or people who had escaped from the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, for example. So people who could talk to their experience living under regimes, authoritarian regimes that had been facilitated by government surveillance, which in turn was facilitated by things like national identity cards, to actually, as I said, kind of build the coalition, build the opposition, so that politicians could start to understand that it is, you know, this idea of if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. The whole point is, or the counter argument is, everyone has something to hide, especially if the government decides the colour of your skin or your ethnicity or your religion is something to hide. So everyone has, could potentially have something to hide. And that doesn't necessarily mean that having something to hide is actually a bad thing. Having something to hide is partly what makes us individuals autonomous, free from government interference, is having control over our own lives, which means we each have some sphere in which we want to be private and autonomous, and that means each of us has effectively something to hide from government. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have something to hide in the sense that we are criminals doing the wrong thing. So I think part of the problem is that human rights are not necessarily well understood or tangible. I guess to make it concrete for people, I'd give two examples. So one is, you know, what's happening right now in Hong Kong. So ordinary people, really ordinary people. It's not just, you know, the kind of, if you like, the traditional activists. It's ordinary mums and dads and shopkeepers and business people and students and grandmothers getting out on the street and protesting for their democratic rights, but having to wear face masks because they fear government surveillance. So we've got that example of ordinary people who never thought that their life plan was going to be as activists. They're the people who would have thought, I've never done anything wrong in my life. I've got nothing to hide. I've got nothing to fear. But suddenly in Hong Kong, because they're standing up for what they believe to be their democratic rights, now they suddenly have something to hide. And that's their face. They have to hide their face from all the facial recognition technology. The other example is in that kind of corporate or capitalist surveillance system where information about us is data and data is worth money. And the kind of examples I see that impact on, if you like, everyday people is online behavioural advertising and the personalisation of services. And this is generally sold to us as a good thing. You know, the more data that Facebook and the rest and Spotify and whoever it is knows about us, the more they can offer us, you know, tailored offerings. They can tell us, here's the goods or services that we think will be best for you, and here's the ads that are relevant for you. But what we don't necessarily realise is that for every time we're offered, oh, here's a product we think you like, and we're offering you a discount because we know you're the kind of person who's interested, that technology also obviously allows price discrimination as well. It can mean that we're shown higher prices than the person next to us. It means that we can be excluded from being shown products or services in the first place. So we've seen examples of ads placed on the Facebook network, for example, where advertisers can choose, I'm not even going to advertise this job to this category of people. I'm not going to advertise my insurance product to people I've already decided are low risk. I'm not going to allow housing or credit to people that I've decided to exclude. And that absolutely perpetuates and exacerbates existing forms of discrimination and exclusion on grounds of socioeconomic disadvantage, ethnicity, religion, class, gender, sexuality, all the rest. So, you know, a lot of people have a lot to lose when their data is being used in a way that is not necessarily transparent to them and is not fair and is not accountable.